Continue with our orientation. And today, members, we're going to be looking at state employee positions and classification system, and then also the information technology operations and consolidation. And we have the benefit of several staff from the Department of Administrative Services to help us through this.
Medical records.
And look to see how this takes us, and we'll move forward with that. We have Sue Wilson, Human Resources Services Division, with us to start off. Ms. Wilson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Susan Wilson. I am Administrator of the Human Resource Services Division within the Department of Administrative Services. And our role is to provide the statewide systems and controls for human resources and personnel practices in the state. And what I've done is, in working with your legislative fiscal staff, put together a presentation that's a pretty high-level overview of personnel in the state with some information, knowing that you're probably going to have some questions and that we'll be happy to try and respond to those. I've been working on information requests with legislative fiscal to try and get any kind of data that we can that might assist you in the work that you're doing. So please feel free to ask. We'll try and put together whatever kind of data you need in the personnel area to help you in your task. Just so that we have sort of a general understanding of what we're talking about when we're talking about human resources, obviously it's the people part of any business, including state government. And what some of the things are that we work on is actually defining the work that needs to be done, defining the skills that are needed then to do the work, determining fair compensation for that work, recruiting and attracting a diverse workforce, retaining then skilled staff, managing people's performance, training and developing staff to take on new tasks, and bargaining of the labor contracts, managing ongoing management of the union relationships, and then tracking all the information that has to do with every employee in state government. That's sort of the breadth of the work that we do and also is done in the agencies, and we'll talk a little bit about whose roles are which. I want to give you an overview of the actual state workforce, some ideas on numbers. As of December 31st, 2004, this is full and part-time positions. In the executive branch, there were about 32,000 positions. Judicial branch, 1,900. In the legislative branch, 300. And in the lottery, 395, about 400. For a total of 34,668. This does not include the university system in those numbers.
Question, Senator Westland.
When you say full and part-time, is that full and part-time added to the equivalent of one FTE?
No. This is actual people. These are the number of people that are employed. So we can provide breakdowns on how many of those are actually working in part-time positions,
okay,
if that would be helpful.
Senator Frater.
I assume this does not include the Oregon University system.
It does not include the university system.
How many are in the Oregon University system, roughly?
Probably around 20,000, but I can get you more specific numbers.
Okay. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Co-Chair, Susan, when you talk about part-time, does that include PERS retirees who have come back to work for the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, no, that does not include, for the most part, that does not include PERS retirees. Mm-hmm. We have another category, which I'll go over here, called temporary employees, who can work for a very specified period of time. And most of the PERS retirees coming back are hired into temporary positions. So they're not included in the count.
All right, follow up. What would be that count?
The actual number of PERS retirees, I suspected that might be a question, and I do have that here. In 2004, and again, this is a total for the year of 2004, we had 289 PERS retirees coming back into work in the state system. The vast majority of those were in temporary positions, which means they are limited to no more than 1,039 hours in a 12-month period. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay. Just again, I sometimes there's questions about what is the breakdown related to managers versus non-managers in the system. Just for the executive department, I've done the breakdown here, and we have 4,411 management staff, 27,655 non-management staff. That's about a 13% management. We also, in state government, we are a highly unionized workforce, and we negotiate 32 labor contracts, separate labor contracts, which covers about 27,000 of the state employees through a variety of labor organizations.
Ms. Wilson, that's not just executive branch, so is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is just executive branch.
The 27,000?
That's correct.
Okay. So out of the 27,655?
Vastly. Again, these are different snapshots taken at any given period of time, but I would say the vast majority of our classified employees are represented by a labor organization.
Okay. All of them. Oh, Representative Hannah.
Yeah. Does that mean that the 4,411 management people are not under a union contract?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hannah, that's correct.
Oh. A question?
Oh, sorry. Senator Gordley. Oh,
thank you very much, and good morning.
Good morning.
Could you talk to us about the diversity within the state workforce? What does that look like?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, we actually have a performance measure that we are working on related to diversity in trying to have the state workforce reflect the same level of diversity as is in the state's overall available workforce. We have made some progress in that. However, we're not up yet to the point. If I saw some numbers yesterday, and I don't believe I actually brought them with me, but I believe that the state available workforce, and I will confirm this, is about 16%+ minority, and that the state workforce is approximately 14%, 12 to 14%. So we have, our numbers have gone up in terms of our ethnic mix, but we are still not up to the performance level that we're trying to get to.
And follow up?
Yes, follow up.
My inquiry also includes gender. What does that look like in our workforce?
I don't have the figures with me on the gender. We do have our numbers related to gender are actually much better than our minority numbers. We have a fair number of females in the state workforce and in management positions.
The final follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair. If you could disaggregate the data that you've referenced and make that available.
Absolutely.
I would appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One out of eight employees in management seems to me to be rather high. And my question is, has the executive branch ever looked thoughtfully at those kinds of ratios and look at reorganization and reassigning responsibilities? And the second question is, have we ever looked at benchmarking against other states and even against other service-type businesses on the private side? And I think that's a very important issue to be looking at.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, that has been a topic that comes up repeatedly in looking at state workforce numbers. Some of the things that we need to look at in terms of management is we do have some management service staff who are non-supervisory, who are in management service because of being in confidential or other positions that put them into management as opposed to actually supervisory. What I will do is get you the specific numbers on supervisory. We have, I think, pretty much every session worked with agencies and trying to say what is your ratio related to. What we found across state government is because of the huge diversity of the programs and in some instances some extremely small programs such as boards and commissions who may have two staff people and a manager, that it's it's sometimes difficult to say overall what the actual ratio is. But that has been something that has been looked at, I know, significantly in a number of the larger agencies to increase that ratio of the number of people supervised by each manager.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Wisnett and Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Mrs. Wilson, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Oregon's ORS, do I have to open the statute? Is that 240.170? What was the intent of that, and especially the exceptions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winsett, can you give me the element of that that you're interested in specifically?
The 1.5.
And I don't have the statute in front of me. I'm sorry.
It's the one that says we can only have 1.5% of our population employed. But then there's four, governor's office, the secretary of state, secretary, treasurer, Supreme Court, and legislative physical office provided me that number is 5,000.
Mm-hmm.
But why was the exceptions included? Do you know that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winsett, I really have no history on that particular piece of legislation. That's been around for quite some time. And I've been with the state for 27 years, and I know that there's always been some sort of limitation related to the population. I don't know. I can do some research. Our budget management division at DAS is the organization that's responsible for determining the numbers on that particular and including it in the budget.
Follow up.
Sure. Follow up.
So should I talk to you or legislative fiscal office to get more information about contractors and consultants, are they counted as employees?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winsett, two questions. One, I believe that probably working with legislative fiscal on the issue about the exceptions to that and the number would probably be the best place to work. We'll be happy to work with them if they need an additional information. And on your question about contractors, no, contractors are not considered state employees. In fact, they are very specifically excluded.
Senator Nelson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on Senator Morris's question, it seemed to me I saw a graph when we showed the entire budget the state of Oregon has, $42 billion over the two-year period. There was 17% of that was administrative cost. And I just would like to have some information if you folks feel that's a high number or if there's some way you can justify it, because it seems like maybe we're a little too top-heavy in that and we're not paying the folks who are actually delivering the services, and we have too much management. I mean, so if you could at some point,
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, there's a lot of things included in administrative costs that aren't personnel related and aren't human resources. I'd be happy to work with legislative fiscal and with our budget management office to sort of break that down.
Thank you.
Senator Bates.
Following up on the same questions, Mr. Co-Chair. We've been through about 4 years of cuts to state government personnel, basically, and I'd like to see a tracking of the last 4 years of the number of people in management versus the number of people non-management. I want to see what's happening to that ratio, one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, that is something that we are working with legislative fiscal to give them all of the data based on number of employees by category over the last five biennia. So we're working on some 10-year trend data that we will have available for you.
Follow up. There's been also a degree of individuals doing the same job, but their categories get changed somehow along the line.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to have that data, if we could, and see if we can wash it out so we can get a real picture of what's going on.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, that is information that we've also provided to Legislative Fiscal Office, and I will speak a little bit to the classification and the reclassifications that we've seen over the past several years.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Continue.
Okay. Human resources, again, as we've talked about, is a framework of the management within the state government. We are regulated and must follow the Oregon Revised Statutes and administrative rules. Federal regulations, a lot of the federal regulations that apply to any business apply to state government as a business in terms of its employees. We are also governed by collective bargaining agreements that we negotiate, and obviously legal decisions that come down also have an impact on what we are able to do in terms of dealing with our state employees. ORS chapters 240 and 243 identify the personnel systems that are required to be part of state government. And the Department of Administrative Services Human Resource Services Division is responsible for the central administration of the state's human resource systems. In the statutes, we are called the Personnel Division. A number of years ago, that was changed to Human Resources. ORS 240-215 requires Department of Administrative Services to adopt a statewide classification plan. And that requires us to group all positions in the classified service into groupings or specific classifications. We base that on the duties of the position, the level of authority that the positions have, and the responsibilities. We tend to do that into areas such as you'll have all the information systems people in a classification group. You'll have administrative support people in a classification group, and then within those classification groups, we have specific job area classifications. We currently have 673 classifications in state government. That's down from about 900 that we've had in the past. We actually have specific statutory direction to reduce the number of classifications as much as possible so that we can group like positions together. We have been in the process of doing that for the past probably 10 years and have reduced the number of classifications to that. We do have an ongoing process to try and keep classifications up to date. As jobs change, classifications change. Classifications include things like what are the knowledge and skills that you need to do these jobs. As the jobs change, the knowledge and skills change. We need to update the classifications to reflect the actual work that's going on. We have some classes, it's a somewhat of a tedious process, that haven't been updated since 1985. We're trying to get to those as soon as we can.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
What about the internal audit or Secretary of State's audit of the various departments? Have there been some recent audits done on efficiencies and so on?
Representative Doyle, Senator Morissette, the Secretary of State's audits are focused generally on a specific topic area. We've had some recent audits that have been in areas like the use of sick leave, the use of temps in the past. We've had audits on those particular things. They will also go into an agency, do some performance auditing and some financial auditing. In terms of auditing specifically related to things like classifications and is it being done properly and is this being used, I have an audit section within our division which actually goes into agencies to look at how they are applying the personnel rules. And we've been doing audits. We audit classifications. We are also auditing sick leave and doing some other topics that specifically come up of interest across state government.
Recently,
in terms of actual full audits, we are involved often in working with management and organizational reviews. We do that at the request of the governor's office, and in doing those situations, we will take a look at any organizational suggestions or management suggestions that we might have. But those do not relate specifically to any sort of the class or systems.
Yes, Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I recall in 01 sitting in a Ways and Means Subcommittee where we discovered a couple of agencies had been reclassifying employees without oversight and, in essence, reclassing employees, taking a lower-classed employee and moving them up into a the responsibilities of a higher level of responsibility within an agency. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to have been, frankly, a subversion of what we were trying to do in terms of giving direction to agencies to hold certain positions vacant. Mm-hmm. For whatever reasons. What has transpired since that time in terms of trying to control that so that we in the legislature have some idea as to what's occurring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, what we have done and what's sort of evolved over the past several years is We have probably tightened down on that process considerably. The process as it exists now in terms of reclassification, if an agency wishes to reclassify a position, they have to identify and do a full analysis of what's the difference in the job, what the change is. They have to show where they have the permanent financing to be able to use the position authority that's been given to them by the legislature and function within that position authority. That is sent to our budget management division at DAS. And in the past, sometimes we didn't formalize the connection. We now have a formal connection with DAS and with my audit staff. And we look at every reclassification package that comes through. And we look at the position description, and we look at the new proposed classification to determine if that's an appropriate classification for that individual to be in. And we look at the overall organization of those particular agencies. I'm not sure how popular this is with the agencies, but it is something that we are now doing on every reclass package that comes through. We were also involved in the development of the 0507 budget. And reclassifications can come through as part of the budget document. We work with budget management, and if there was a reclassification in any budget that came through from an agency, we reviewed that reclass to determine if it was the appropriate thing to do with that individual.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Again, just a follow-up on the reclassification issue. It's my impression that there was a point in time where there were some agencies that had the ability to process reclassifications without any feedback outside of the agency. I'm curious as to whether that is still the case, and if it is, what the agencies are. And then I'm also curious about what the feedback loop is into this body about the what the reclassifications are and the ramifications from the budget perspective of that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, there are no agencies currently that can on their own simply do a reclass without it coming through Department of Administrative Services. We have, in the past, there have been agencies that you may have heard of as being certified. They were allowed to do some things related to their comp systems and other things. We have revoked, no longer have any certified agencies, most of which was made moot by the administrative restrictions that we're operating under. So it just became that there really wasn't anything for agencies to do under that certification. So there are no agencies out there doing that specifically. We are gathering all the information on what happens with reclasses. Again, agencies have to show that if they're going to go up in cost or something, that they have lowered the cost of something else. So we have agencies, if they reclass a position up, they may have to reclass another position down to balance that out. That's part of the financing plan that's given to budget and management, which they do as part of the reclassification package. So we are reporting, and I have given lists of all the reclasses to Legislative Fiscal, the numbers.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Co-Chair Doyle. I'm a little slow in digesting information, so I'm a page or two back with my question. Can you send me information on how our governor, whether Republican or Democrat, I want to be open on this, avoids potential conflicts of interest or potential ethics violations when it comes to negotiating labor negotiations, when they potentially are attending events or receiving campaign contributions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I will certainly talk with some folks and see if we can get your response to that. I don't have one for you today.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Hannah.
Mr. Co-Chair, thank you. In regards to the classifications, are there classifications here that have one or two employees? I mean, because we could have a classification for every 50 or so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hannah, let me, on this slide, I want to give an idea when we talk about, you know, because I know 673 sounds like a lot of classifications, mm-hmm. probably does. The breadth of the work that's done in state government, I think, is often surprising to many people. I think members of the public might think that it's largely a clerical staff. I think rather that we have some highly specialized areas in state government. I don't know how many communicable disease inspectors we have, but that is a very specific job function, and we won't have a lot of those. But you can see from this list, and I just kind of looked at the ABCs and pulled some out, to give you an idea of the types of classifications that we're dealing with in state government: biological technicians, auto mechanics, chemists, clinical psychologists. It's a very, very diverse workforce, and in many cases a very highly skilled workforce because of the jobs that are required to be done.
Okay. Please proceed.
Can I make a comment, Mr. Co-Chair?
Oh, Senator Schrader.
One of the things I think would be beneficial for the group based on the questions I've heard so far would be to see if we can get someone in here to chat, maybe Sue, to a certain extent, on how it used to be done. There was a point in time when the legislature reviewed all classifications and reclasses. I guess the obvious question that this group would want asked is, why don't we do that now? You know, it's a topic of interest. I know, personally, it's a huge workload is one of the answers, but I guess I'd like to hear, Sue, your perspective on why that was changed, how we're better off because that has changed, and there's a certain intermediate road that we should be at that's different than where we are now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, I'd be happy to kind of do at some point, because we're working on all these trend documents right now, trying to build the picture over the last five biennia, that would fit in quite well with that and what's actually happened policy in relationship to the trends.
All right. That'd be fine.
Talking a little bit about compensation, everybody's favorite topic. ORS 242-35 requires that we have a merit pay system in state government and requires that we take into account individual performance, the market analysis, what's our relationship to other people performing similar work, the living costs, maintenance, other benefits received, or any obligations established under our collective bargaining agreements. The state's financial condition and policies obviously also plays into how we look at our overall compensation system. A major review of the state's compensation system was done in 1985. Comparable worth was generally the title given to that. It realigned all of the state jobs using the Hay method, which is an adopted compensation method, analysis method of state government. Any position that is created now goes through an analysis with the Hay system to determine where it falls within the full hierarchy of state government in terms of compensation levels. This creates some interesting issues, and this is an area where we need to be doing some additional work. We're trying to decide how we need to best do that. The way we have it set up is the state is one employer. State government is one employer. Every state employee's work responsibility is balanced against other state employees' work and responsibilities. So, for example, probably the highest paid individuals are those who are going to be the agency heads of the very, very large agencies. We have a number of other then hierarchy down from that in terms of the responsibility areas of the individuals managing programs and how they relate against that. And I can talk later a little bit about some of the trends we're seeing that are a little bit troubling in terms of our ability to compete against the market in highly technical areas, such as the medical fields, within our state compensation structure. Because our agency heads are not making what a pharmacist can make in the private sector or a doctor or at the nursing situation is somewhat critical at this point in time, too. So we're really struggling with that, and these are questions that we're going to have to deal with. But we are having some recruitment and retention problems in some of these areas.
You forgot university professors, too.
We don't actually compare our executive branch against university professors. That'd be
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I went through some of the early hearings in the 1980s on pay equity, and the resulted in this classification system and compensation system in 85. My experience with public agencies, which is somewhat limited, has been that they do this on a more regular basis, look at their entire classification compensation system rather than piece by piece. How do we compare to other states in the time that it's been since we've actually done a full comp and classification study? And not being entirely familiar with the Hays system, is it a common system that's being used by other states in the area, or are there other systems being used in terms of classification?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I have had some opportunity to communicate with some other states and work through an organization of state personnel executives. There are probably as many different compensation systems as there are states. Everybody has a little bit different twist on it. We have some states who have no union. In state government, we have others who have a much more highly direct appointment by the governor to a large level of the employees. We are finding there are some states, the Hays system is a fairly standard for a number of administrative operations. And a lot of states, however, are moving away from the merit system, from the step salaries, and moving to some more broadly banded salaries. At the same time, I am reviewing articles that I'm getting right now from every other state, and the comp and class systems are up for discussion just about everywhere.
Follow up.
Is it pretty rare for a state to go as long as we've gone, 20 years, in doing a full comp and classification study? Or
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, no.
No,
no, it's not. Some state governments, it's been considerably longer than that.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, a layperson's sort of response to that sometimes is, I know that you've cut the number of the classifications since 96, but I think they grew quite a bit since 1985. It's kind of get the impression sometimes that you originally had a three-bedroom house, and now you've got a 13-bedroom mansion, and you've added piece by piece. And I'm wondering just how clear the lines are throughout this in terms of things being valid in terms of the analysis of the classification. It's just that's a rhetorical question, Mr. Chairman, but thank you for your response.
Representative Morgan, then Senator Morsett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Many of us come from areas of the state where the economy is not as vibrant as it is in the Willamette Valley. And one of the issues that we're faced with is that the people that have government jobs in those districts often have the best jobs. They have the highest compensation levels and the best benefit levels. And the question often arises about how the state comes up with what the worth of a job is, and I'm wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about that process.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, there is a whole set of criteria under the Hay, which again relates more to the areas of responsibility, the decision-making authority of the individual. It does not relate to geographic location. And so the classifications and the compensation system that we set up is set up statewide. We look at all of the jobs as they are, regardless of where they are located in state government. Now, I understand that probably some of the state jobs, and that's why some more rural areas are very happy to get state offices. But we also have the same issues, for example, that I mentioned with some of the medical folks that we can't get to go, or there isn't a pool of those people in the rural areas, and we can't afford to get people there. So it's a combination of things. What I'd be happy to do is to get for you the specific criteria that's under Hay, the Hay system that sets up, here's what we look at to determine where you fit in the hierarchy of compensation.
May I have a follow-up, Mr. Kocher? I think what the interest is in understanding how those rates are set, what you use as the indicators. Are they based on the wages that you need to pay in the Portland metro area to fill the job? I think that there needs to be more clarity around how that system operates and how those compensation levels are set.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, we do use market studies in looking at those rates of compensation. Where are we for that particular classification of job in relationship to private sector in Oregon, in relation to public sector jobs in relation to other states to see where we are. Most of our jobs are probably below market at this point in time in terms of, but we do use a statewide market. We do not use a specific geographic area. There are times when we are involved in arbitrations and in bargaining where some of the geographic questions will arise and we'll do some specific geographic market analysis.
You got it.
Yeah, just sure. I think that the piece of this that's confusing to me could probably be helped along by seeing some specific instances of how this is done.
You bet. We'll be happy to get you some examples.
And just interesting sideline with that is the impact that these state government wages being paid out in these rural areas have on prevailing wage rates for those regions. Mm-hmm. That you know, we have the public contract work that they have. They're based on regional surveys, and so here we are at the state level driving up, you know, inherently the cost of the prevailing wage to you know, then costing more for us to build public works projects as well. Senator Morissette.
Thank you. My question was, what is the Hays system? Representative Morgan asked that question in detail, and I would really like to understand how we classify and evaluate the criteria.
Senator Doyle, Senator Morissette, we will be happy to get some sort of a summary on that for you.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Co-Chair and Mr. Wilson, I'm concerned about the future as far as the competitiveness of our wage structure for Oregon when we consider the cost of a position, you know, not just salary, but the entire cost of position. I looked through the considerations under ORS 240.235. My understanding is that the cost for PERS starting next July is going to be, you know, roughly 18.5% plus the employee pickup, which is 6%. I believe the state pays that. Mm-hmm. So now we're looking at almost, you know, 24.5% to 25% of every dollar of wage going strictly for a PERS payment, which is going to go on for years, and so that obviously drives up the cost of a position. Do you think that there's going to be a lessening of wage, actually the salary paid, because of the consumption of position, you know, allocation funds for the PERS system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, we do not, in looking at the wages of an individual when we bargain, etc., take into account that extra cost, employer cost, related to PERS. The employer pickup of the 6% is considered, that is a bargained issue, and that is a bargained benefit that we do have. That additional of employer cost is not something that is taken into consideration when we look at the cost of how we determine the actual wage for the individual. That is a cost to the system, but it is not a cost that's attributed to an individual.
Okay. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I want to go back to the discussion just for a moment on the urban-rural issue as far as pay is concerned. Mm-hmm. First, you know, I'm from a rural area also, and I share your concern or your point that quite often the government jobs are the best jobs in our rural communities, and frankly, I'm glad they are. Most of the jobs are, the funding for most of those jobs comes from the urban areas. The rural areas do not produce a tax base to produce those jobs, and so it's really a shift of income from the cities to the rural areas, which helps bridge that divide. Also, in medicine and the urban health plan, we at one time were paying physicians less in rural areas than we were in the urban areas for taking care of urban health patients. As a result, we started losing providers. Physicians in the rural areas would not take on OHP patients because they couldn't afford to. Their costs were not that significantly different than they were anywhere else in the state for running a practice, and quite frankly, in many places in the state. Now, housing isn't any cheaper than it was. I think 15 years ago it was cheaper in rural areas, but a lot of those rural areas now have a heavy cost for housing. So the bottom line here is that I don't have a big concern about this. It's a really a shift of revenue from city to rural, which I appreciate. It gives us an opportunity to have skilled workers out in our communities. And I think it's an overall, it's a plus for rural communities. There is the downside that it drives higher wages across the board in rural areas, and I understand that. But overall, I think if you analyze it from the point of view of where that money is already flowing, it's a plus for your rural communities that we have this kind of a wage scale to support our rural communities. Thank you.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I want to make sure that I understand the information you provided shows the ORS 240.235 a merit pay system, and so I read that in your slide and so forth. Is that the STEP system? And okay, so can you help me understand what percentage of the determination for their pay is the pay, which I don't totally understand yet? Because what we get from the Legislative Fiscal Office, and I'll just read this sentence, it says salary ranges have 7 or 8 steps, and the step for which the employee is paid is based primarily on seniority. So if it's primarily on seniority, is it 80% seniority and 20% hay, or help us understand that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hannah, the hay system sets that range. What we look at in terms of is the hay system sort of prioritizes or creates the hierarchy of where those jobs fit within the overall mix of our jobs. And then that's related to a range. When we do market studies, we look at average, we look at low, we look at high. And the systems, the STEP systems are set up reflecting those. So we do have an entry level and a senior, in essence, as you work your way through the steps of a particular salary range. Now, most classifications do have 7 or 8 steps in their salary range. Between each steps is about 4.75%. That's the average.
Mm-hmm.
And the thought is that the lower end is entry level. As you gain knowledge and as you demonstrate merit, ability, you move a step a year up that particular range. Agencies do have the ability to hire people at different steps of that range, depending on experience, depending on where they are currently in their salary, if it's a promotion coming over from another job. So that whole range is used to reflect the growth within a job area. But the hay system sort of sets where that whole range fits within the hierarchy of all the other jobs.
If I may?
Follow up.
But I appreciate your description of that. I don't feel like we still understand when this says primarily, I'd like to understand if I'm a state employee and I've worked my third year,
mm-hmm.
and I'm meeting with my manager and I can sit down and look them in the eye and say, look, I've been here 3 years. I know that my primary determination for receiving my step increase is seniority. I'd like to understand what percent of the other measurement is something measured under hay.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the hay system actually has nothing to do with whether or not you receive any sort of merit step. The hay sets the overall framework for the classification and the system. When you sit down with your employer and you go through an evaluation and they say you have been here, you've done the job, you've made the progress, you'll get your merit step. It's based on being here and doing the job. Okay. I think everybody is pretty realistic that it is very rare that people do not receive their annual merit step. Now, the exception obviously being in this last most recent biennium where all the merit steps have been frozen and no one has received any merit steps for the past 2 years.
Okay.
But it is generally related to your performance evaluation, and at that time, then you are recommended. It does happen, and it is possible for a manager to not give that merit step.
Thank you.
And I'm looking, since we've got about another 15 minutes mm-hmm. for your portion of this presentation, let's see if we can get through
okay.
as much of that as possible, and we'll hold questions more to the end.
The question often arises in terms of where people are coming in, and that's why I wanted this note on this slide, that for the past 10 years, over half of the new hires that have been coming into the state have been hired at the first step of the range, so truly are being viewed as entry-level positions. Again, the challenges that we face as a statewide system is that we are one employer, and we are a very diverse employer in state government. We are trying to balance overall equity within the system with very unique needs that agencies have, depending on the work that they are doing, their locations, and the charges that they have in front of them. So that's just simply the challenge that's out there and what we do struggle with. I believe that you have information that on an information brief that Legislative Fiscal put together for you that probably walks through all this pretty carefully, but just very quickly, if a new position is needed for a body of work, the agency develops a package. These are the packages that will come through the budget process. That package is submitted to BAM. Again, we audit for the classifications that are in those packages to see if they're appropriate. If the legislature reviews and passes that budget package, then the position is established in the position inventory control system, which we'll never hear anyone use that terminology. It's PICS. And that means that the position is officially established. We then transfer that position into our personnel position and personnel database, which is the database that contains information on every state employee. We have all of your information. And then the agency is able to recruit for that position. They go through the prescribed hiring process. An employee is hired and put on the payroll. At that point in time, then the actual information related to that employee is entered into the PPDB system. That is the system that then rolls up to produce the payroll for all of state government. So we have these systems tied, and I'll be back here when we're doing our budget to talk about the antiquity of our information system related to trying to maintain all of that information and get the information we need out of that. Other types of appointments, which have been talked about in some of the questions here, temporary hires. An agency can hire an individual as a temporary employee. They may work for, they're there statutorily for specific emergency non-recurring work. And they may work in that agency not to exceed 6 months or 1,040 hours. So if they worked part-time, it would go longer potentially than 6 months. Again, the state is one employer. They may work 1,040 hours for the state of Oregon. That doesn't mean they can work that for agency X and then go to agency Y and do another 1,040. That is overall for the state. We also have limited duration positions, and I outlined this because this is something that the legislature sometimes uses as a tool, and it's also something that's used by budget management. It's a position that's created that will expire at the end of the biennium. And again, it's something that's probably put in for a one-time identified workload. I believe that a lot of the PERS positions that were created in the budget for the 2003-2005 were limited duration positions, assuming that there was a need to catch up on the backlog and then that need would go away. So those positions were used in that way. Again, we've talked pretty much about reclassifications. If a change occurs in the work that results in the need to change the job class, and there are business reasons that drive that, such as really being a change in a business process. What you're going to see most often right now in terms of reclassifications are going to be reorganizations within agencies, trying to realign the workload to deal with getting the work done with potentially fewer resources. And there may be some work assignment changes due to that. That can result in reclassifications. If a new law or a policy is implemented, it can often result. Again, we need those to be able to respond to program priorities, and we review all those through our audit program to ensure that they're going to the classification they need to go to. We've talked about going through the budget packages. Now, what we often do also is, and we are in the process now, for example, of doing an administrative study or doing a reclass study on a certain group. Right now, we're looking at the trades and crafts and looking at the classifications as they existed, what's happened with those jobs, what are the skills and abilities that are needed now, how have those changed over the years, what are the needs. We will then create those classes. If those are represented positions, the salary range, in addition to the recommendation under the Hay system, will also have to be bargained because the salary ranges for those are bargained in addition. And then we will make our recommendations, and the agencies will then put the individuals into the appropriate classification. Wanted you to be aware of the administrative restrictions that have been underway in this biennium, and our agency has been playing a significant role in those administrative restrictions. It's been a very interesting process and a lot of work. Beginning July 1, 2003, the governor instituted a series of administrative restrictions, some of which, there were a variety of them, but some of which had to do with human resource management. First of all the merit steps, as we talked about, were frozen for all management and unrepresented employees. We also went into collective bargaining with the directive that we were to bargain for as much as possible a step freeze for under all the bargaining units. We were able to do that with all the bargaining units, and you'll see here that we say it's for a 24-month period. The reason for that is that SEIU, which is our largest union, was bargained and became effective July 1. They had a freeze for the biennium, a 24-month period of time. Not all of our union contracts finish at the same time. So, for example, we had some contracts where we reached settlement or they became effective September 1. In a letter of agreement with those unions, we said your freeze will be for a 24-month period of time. So, in essence, under the letter of agreement, the freeze is on until September 1, 2005. So that was bargained through all the various.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Pratt.
Thank you. And just quickly, read a story in the newspaper today about audit performed, some discomfort in the legislative body about higher education, University of Oregon, Oregon State, I think, granting about $800,000 of pay increases to administrative or whomever. And that seemed to fly in the face of the spirit of what we were trying to achieve last session, and certainly with what you've just put on the screen. What's the status of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kropp, I wish I knew from the university system. We really have no involvement whatsoever in theirs. I'd be happy to try and get information, but we're not involved with the university system. Within our branches, our branch of government, however, any time anybody wanted to do anything that was at all outside of those restrictions, which included things like hiring people low in the range, if you got a promotion, you only got one step. If people wanted to do anything outside of that, they had to come to us and outline a business reason and ask. Probably the majority of the exceptions that we received related to agencies hiring people from outside of state government. They wanted to bring them in above step four because they were trying to match a salary. When we could do that, when our whole overall was not to harm anyone but to try and hold costs, we would try to match that salary. The same with people promoting from one agency to another. They got one step. They got a 5%. I think the executive branch has kept a pretty close lid on those administrative restrictions. And, again, I have provided some fairly detailed reports to the Legislative Fiscal Office on every exception request that we have received and what's happened.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Morgan probably has some things to add to that.
Representative Kropp, we received that audit in the interim audit committee, and we spent quite a bit of time going through it. I'd be very glad to spend time with you outside this venue discussing it.
That's good.
We're almost through. That's well.
Yeah. Again, 2003-2005 has really seen a pretty high rate of separations. Along with that, there's been a large number of new hires and promotions to fill in with those separations. Separation numbers in 2003 increased about 35%, and about 30% of all the people leaving state employment left due to retirement. That's about double the number that we normally see. We're not seeing that same trend continue at least at that higher rate in 2004. Anecdotally, what we hear from agencies is their employees are waiting to see what happens with court cases and what happens with PERS in general before they make the decision on whether or not they're going to leave. Depending on how things happen, we could see another outflow of state agencies.
Thank you, Chair, Co-Chair Doyle. Have any committees done an analysis of the cost of replacing workers?
Bring a new employee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we have some market data. We have some benchmark data about the costs associated with recruiting, hiring, training. We haven't done a lot of that specifically related to what's happening in state agencies specifically.
Let me rephrase my question. Has there been any type of efficiency analysis done on the relative loss of efficiency of bringing in a new person relative to losing someone with experience?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, no, we have not done an efficiency study on that.
Thank you.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Co-Chair, Ms. Wilson, has there been any creations or changes in classifications that would allow an employee to not be included in the 1040 hours limitation for PERS?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, there is one piece of legislation that allowed to go beyond the 1040 and PERS specifically related, I believe, to correctional officers in certain geographic areas where they were needing to have the workforce. Other than that, I have not seen anything specifically that would increase the hours under PERS.
Okay, follow up. I think I understand that legislation. It also applied to, like, certain education in smaller communities and or smaller counties. But what I'm wondering is, are there any classifications that would avoid being awarding PERS? In other words, could somebody work in a classification and not be covered by PERS and therefore not be subject to a consideration of the 1040 rule?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, really the only positions that we have that would allow would be a temporary hire. Everything else would be a status position, which would fall under the statutes.
Thank you.
Senator Gordley has a question, then we'll let you get to your last slide after that question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I would like to link the discussion that we're having around workforce trends back to the slide that you have on page 7, speaking to challenges. And I'd like to draw on your earlier testimony wherein you noted that the state of Oregon as an employer has some challenges in attaining a diverse workforce. And I would just note to our co-chairs and to the committee that one of the opportunities we will have this session is to aggressively find out through the work of the subcommittees how the various agencies are meeting the policy outlined in ORS 243305. That's the policy on affirmative action. And particularly with regard to what we're now experiencing, which is separation, the loss of people employed by state government. What is the impact on affirmative action, and how are we looking at that? And I do want to read the statute for all of us to understand and internalize. It states, it is declared to be the public policy of Oregon that all branches of state government shall be leaders among employing entities within the state in providing to its citizens and employees through a program of affirmative action fair and equal opportunities for employment and advancement in programs and services and in the awarding of contracts. Part 2 of this policy says affirmative action means a method of eliminating the effects of past and present discrimination, intended or unintended, on the basis of race, religion, national origin, age, sex, marital status, or physical or mental disabilities. Again, I read that for the record because we are challenged as a state when it comes to how we are, in fact, achieving diversity in our workforce. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thanks, Senator.
This, again, just relates to the workforce trends that we see, that with people leaving, we are finding people coming in new hire positions. That does increase our need for training and development. We're also seen a lot higher level of promotions. And at the same time, we're starting to see some real recruitment and retention difficulties in some specialty areas. We are trying to document those and get as much information as we can on those so that we can talk about strategies to address that. That's all that I have. At any point in time, Mr. Chair, as deliberations are going on, if there is data that's needed related to the personnel system that we can help generate out of our database or in general, please let me know. We'll be happy to do whatever we can.
Very good. Thank you for your presentation. Any further questions, Ms. Wilson? Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This really isn't a question. It's a concern, one that's plagued me for quite some time.
Okay.
Looking at step increases, which you project at an average of 4.75, and then add the COLAs, and then add what would be at least a 5% pension smoothing effect for this next year, and add the health issues to it, and we're looking at a minimum of 12 to 13, 14% per year increase in labor, and government operates mostly on labor. What, 80 to 85% labor costs? Something doesn't compute here. The revenue stream it just does not support what is just absolutely built in to cost increases. And I don't know how we're going to do it. That's just a kind of an observation. And any question to that would certainly be rhetorical at this point.
Thank you. Senator Devin.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I would agree with some of Senator Morse's comments, although I would highlight one issue in that, and that is that step increases only occur for those employees who are still eligible for step increases. And a goodly portion of the state workforce probably is no longer eligible for a step increase. And if they are an employee that they are eligible for a step increase, they're not. But by just practice, they are a lower paid employee, so you might be having a new employee come into a position that costs you less for them to perform that service than someone that's already actually at the top of their steps. And I would think we would see that in, particularly in the Department of Corrections, as we have so many new employees, that those new correctional officers are costing a lot less than correctional officers that are at the top of their steps. But you don't get step increases after you get to the top of your range.
Senator Winters.
Just a quick question. You raised an interesting point, Senator Devlin, and the question becomes, what is the rate then of how much time does it take to reach the top of your step, number one? And certainly I think we realize that when people retire and you get new people in, that it costs you're going back down to the one or two steps. I want to go back because you recommend and encourage one and two steps for a new hire person coming in, and yet the agency doesn't have to get from you a buy-in until it's the fourth step. Why did you skip three?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, it's actually the agency can offer up to the fourth step. That was to enable some flexibility in terms of trying to be able to attract and match salary levels. We've got above the fourth step, I think partially because then we would be getting into the top half of the range, and the workload of actually reviewing absolutely every hire in state government was not something that we really wanted to take on. We do still have our running data and finding out where people are actually naming, and people are, the numbers hired at the first and second step have actually increased, so the trend is holding.
There used to be the practice of once the person had reached the top of their step that in certain instances, then you would get a request for reclassification so that that person could then begin the step process all over again. Is that still occurring, and if it is, how frequent?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we can get all the data on where we are in terms of who's at the top steps and where we are, but we're not seeing that as a standard once somebody reaches the top of the branch.
Further questions of Ms. Wilson? All right. Thank you, Ms. Wilson. And just as a clarification, too, for members, There have been a lot of requests made of Ms. Wilson this morning, and at the same time, LFO also has matters that they're dealing with Ms. Wilson's division as well. So the co-chairs at least are asking you to make sure you coordinate these requests with our legislative fiscal office. I think some of those answers probably are going to be able to come from LFO and then be able to, you know, kind of work through that so that everybody gets their questions answered. But I think we can probably make sure that, you know, we're not duplicating efforts.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We have to do that.
And now bring forward Mike Priest, the Deputy Director of the Information Resource Management Division. Talk about information technology operations and consolidation. And maybe he can give us a status report on his director, too, who I guess just didn't have a very good weekend, it sounded like.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Fries, Deputy State Chief Information Officer, and I'm standing in today for Don Fleming, who performed an involuntary but undoubtedly spectacular acrobatic feat during the ice storm and is at home recuperating from that right now, so a less than perfect landing, evidently. I'm here to talk with you today about the Information Resources Management Division, and we're a division within the Department of Administrative Services, the largest division, actually, in terms of staffing and budget. We have a workforce of approximately 300 FTE, engaged in a variety of activities directly related to information technology management and some ancillary activities such as publishing and distribution, mail processing. We have offices and programs located in six buildings in three cities, Portland, the Salem area, of course, and then we have the archive center, a data archive center that we operate in Burns, Oregon, that employs some staff out there. In the head of the division is Don Fleming, the State Chief Information Officer, who, again, apologizes for not being able to be here with you today. Our mission is really to provide leadership within state government for effective development, management, and enhancement of digital technologies, specifically information technology. And we also provide what we would call core infrastructure services, networking and so on, telecommunications that enable state government to conduct its business. We have a variety of statutory authorities, and we also operate under some executive orders in the realm of geospatial information and so on, which I'll talk about, any government, which I'll talk about a little bit later. To give you a good high-level overview of the organization and what it does, we really want to talk about IRMD in three categories. One is what I'll call operations. Those are those infrastructure services, technology services that we provide to state government, and in some cases to other political subdivisions. Governance and oversight, and that's our role supporting both you and the executive branch in making sure that information technology investments are made wisely and that projects stay on track, and we have an oversight role, an active involvement role, and I'll talk in more detail about that later on. And then some enterprise programs, some of which you may have heard of. These are really about producing change, producing something that works better than what we have today. And an example of that is the Computing and Networking Infrastructure Consolidation Project, also known as CNIC. Some of you may have heard about that, and I'll talk about that a little bit later on. So let's start with operations. One of the programs within operations is voice communications. And over time, what's happening is something, a phenomenon called technological convergence. And this is, you may have heard of voice over IP or voice and data convergence. This is something that the state of Oregon is positioning itself to be able to do to help reduce the cost of that. But we basically run an internal telephone company providing telecommunication services, voice services to state agencies. And our rates there are very competitive at $34, for instance, for a handset. It's cheaper than what we could buy it off the street. We run a telecommunications infrastructure that supports that and supports 52,000 state employees. We also negotiate competitive rates for both voice services and telecommunications services in general. The publishing and distribution operation is the state printing plant and the centralized state mail facility. We provide agencies with graphic design services, everything from basically conception of documents on through to publishing and distribution. We handle bulk letter processing. A number of years ago, starting in 1996, we began a consolidation project and consolidated states multiple printing and mailing operations, and that project has produced literally millions of dollars in savings since that time because we're able to qualify outgoing postal mail at the lowest possible postal rate. That was one of the advantages of consolidating that. We also reduced duplicate operations within state government. The systems development and consulting operation, these are the programmers. These are people that support existing centralized applications that all state agencies use. For instance, the personnel and payroll database that Sue Olson talked about earlier, the statewide financial management application. We provide support and enhancement for those applications. The Orbitz system, the budget tracking system and budget development system. The other thing that we do is we provide some consulting services and also some programming services and coordination services for state agencies as the need arises, because typically, particularly with smaller agencies, they may have a discrete need that comes along once every 3 to 4 years for some enhancement or an application development, and they certainly wouldn't staff up for that, so we will provide that service to them and coordinate that. Let me talk about governance and oversight. We have an enterprise planning and policy office, and that office provides support for IT governance bodies. And that's one of the things that, by the way, is different, I think, today from the way state government operated with respect to information technology just a few years ago. State government tends to be organized in a decentralized way, and that makes a lot of sense if you think about the history of how agencies were created. They were created to fulfill specific public policy objectives and to solve specific problems, and each one of them has their own infrastructure to support that to some degree. And so historically, each agency has evolved much of its own information technology capability. Over the last few years, one of the things that we've been doing, as information technology has become increasingly important and critical to state agencies, is begun collaborating and working together. So we have a state chief information officer council, and that's comprised of the person who's primarily responsible for information technology in the major agencies. They meet on a regular basis, and they work through issues such as defining standards so that we can leverage economies of scale and so that we can intercommunicate more easily to put us in a place to do things more efficiently and effectively in the future. So we support those kinds of governance bodies. One of them that I'll talk about a little bit later is the Scenic Governing Board and the Steering Committee that's associated with the Scenic Project. We also are responsible for statewide policy development and promulgation, and again, we do that working with those bodies, and then we're the body that's responsible for actually promulgating those policies, standards, architecture, and so on. We also are responsible for managing IT investments, including strategic planning. And the state we're in the process right now, actually, of updating the state's information technology strategic plan. And typically, an information technology strategic plan should be created for the purpose of supporting a state business plan. And it's difficult to develop an enterprise information technology plan in the absence of an enterprise state business plan, but we have worked with state agency heads and with their technical folks to produce a process to produce that strategic plan and update it. And that will lay out for us some of the key objectives over the course of the next few years that will help reduce the cost, presumably, of information technology. That's one area we want to focus on, and also to be able to produce new capabilities and create some efficiencies. We're also responsible for coordinating IT asset management. A few years ago, the state of Oregon probably could not answer the question, how many PCs do we have installed out there and connected to the network, and how much are we spending in information technology? Those are things that IT asset management will help us get a handle on, and they will also help us manage technology through its life cycle, because technology tends to have a fairly short life, and it needs to be managed effectively for it to be an effective tool to support agency business needs. We also have an oversight and reporting function. We perform quality assurance, and we coordinate quality assurance for information technology projects. And we're repositioning that program to be more effective than it has been in the past. One of the things we're really focusing on is trying to focus on those areas where we get the biggest bang for the buck. So we're focusing on what we call strategic investments. And those can be defined as investments that either have a high dollar value and or impact on the agency and high potential risk, or investments that may be relatively small but could set a trend for the foreseeable future. They might establish a de facto standard that's going to require additional investment over time.
Co-Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Co-Chair Doyle. When you're making those investments, are you matching up the useful life of the investment with the terms of or the methods of payment for them, and making sure that the methods of payment are not on a longer term than the useful life of the equipment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yeah, that's a very good question. You certainly wouldn't want to, for instance, use something like certificates of participation over a 10-year period to finance something that has a 3-year life cycle. So, yeah, we do look at that. That would be part of the business case that would justify the investment.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we're focusing, again, on the big dollar items and those things that could have substantial risk associated with them and or our strategic investments. Two projects that we have been involved in were the implementation of the new system at PERS to support some of the changes that were made during the last legislature to the retirement system, and with the Medicaid Management Information System, MMIS, at Department of Human Services, which is a key system for them. So let's talk a little bit about this enterprise programs piece, and this is where really what this is an incubator for either creating new programs and new capabilities that to support the business needs of state agencies and or transforming existing operations in a way that makes them more cost-effective and efficient. And there's really two categories of this kind of thing. One is what I'll call attacking the base. And this is the proposition here is that things we're doing today that are ongoing operations, there may be a way to do them more efficiently and effectively. That's what the Scenic project is about, in fact. And so what we want to try to do is reduce the cost of providing those infrastructure services by either applying more modern technology or different management practices or consolidating what are currently distributed operations. And then the other piece of this is establishing new capabilities, because we can't, while we're trying to reduce the cost or at least control the cost of information technology infrastructure, we can't stay frozen in time over the course of the next few years for reasons which I'll talk about a little bit later. Enterprise programs, as they go through the incubation phase, then move into operations. They become ongoing operations once we have a well-defined and stable product and service. And an example of this is the e-government program. Electronic government is currently sort of in an incubation mode. Over time, that will become more mature and more used more widely and adopted by state agencies. It will have a more well-defined finance strategy. Today, that's supported by assessment. Over time, it could become a fee-for-service or that kind of an operation. It's accepted and valued by the customer base and will be competitive with other alternatives. So if we can produce that internally more inexpensively than we could buy it. And not every technology, by the way, is a candidate for an enterprise program. Key thing we're looking for when we consolidate or when we look at it at the enterprise level is commonality and scalability. So something where you have highly common business needs, an example might be email. Everybody uses email, but there's nothing particularly unique about what the requirements are around email. And then can we, by aggregating that, can we do it more effectively, either through leveraging pricing discounts or running it more efficiently in a central location? Those new strategies are produced both through the strategic planning process and by working through the Chief Information Officer Council that I described earlier. And prior to the implementation of that CIO Council, by the way, there really wasn't a body or a way to take a look for enterprise opportunities across state government. So that has been tremendously valuable in just identifying where some of those opportunities are. The next slide talks a little bit about, it actually expands on the concept I just talked about, which is when we take a look at an information technology strategy, and in the strategic planning process, we'll identify some strategies that have the potential for an enterprise approach and others that are going to be agency-specific, that meet a specific agency's business needs, an application that supports their line of business and is not necessarily applicable to other state agencies. So we'll sort them into two different buckets, and one's going to be a common application portfolio or a common technology strategy, infrastructure strategy, or one that's unique and should remain with the agency. We want to track both of those, and you'll see the unique ones show up in an agency-specific technology plan, and the enterprise or common ones show up in an enterprise technology plan. We're introducing a new concept here, too, called shared services, and I'm going to talk in a little more detail about why that's different than just centralization or consolidation, because it's kind of an important element of this that ensures success of those centralized information technology enterprise strategies over time. And shared services is allowing us to add a new component to the default business model for the state, which is agency-centric for the reasons I described earlier. And we think that we need to have both, because for those things for which there are economies of scale, we need to be able to leverage those. For those things that are agency-specific, we still need to be able to move those forward, and there are not necessarily advantages to centralizing those. Some of the enterprise programs that we're running today, the Scenic Project, and we're consolidating 12 agency data centers and networks, working through with this collaborative governance body that I'll describe in a little more detail in a minute. E-government, again, delivering state information, goods, and services through the Internet. Geospatial utility, providing geographic information systems, data, and services, and coordinating geospatial activity amongst multiple government bodies, both state and local and federal. Information security, which I'll talk a little bit about, but not in too much detail, for reasons that will be self-evident as I talk about it. And business continuity planning to ensure that state operations can recover quickly from any disruption. Quick overview of the Scenic Project. The goal of the project is really two primary goals. One is to reduce the cost of operating our computing and networking infrastructure through consolidation, but we also want to at least maintain the current service levels, and we have a good reason to believe that we can improve service levels. One of the reasons we believe we can improve service levels is that we discovered some things as we did the analysis for the Scenic Project. And the way the project was structured was there's an analysis phase which resulted in a business case. And the way that analysis is conducted is we take a look, we do an inventory basically of what we've got, both the technical infrastructure and the staff associated with operating that. And then we compare that to industry benchmarks for the same kind of infrastructure. And we determine whether it's more expensive for us to do it the way we're doing it or it's less expensive. And what we find is that is kind of interesting. We don't have very many data centers in the state, really. We have three what you would call, what most people would call and recognize as data centers, and they're very small. Those three data centers combined comprise about 60% of what by industry standards would be a medium-sized data center. And when we add in the other nine, we get to about 75% of what it would, by industry standards, would be a medium-sized data center. And because data centers tend to get more cost-effective, they scale up to a really tremendous size before you start to lose economies of scale. There are some self-evident opportunities there, and that's what the business case showed us. It also showed us some other things, though. It showed us that we don't have very good current tested disaster recovery capabilities in our existing data centers, and these are things that we find that have plagued us for some time. And it's not because people don't know that they need to do that. They do. We have very capable people running those data centers, but we're operating at such a small scale that those things almost become unaffordable luxuries at that scale. So that's one of the advantages that we'll gain from consolidating. And this is a topic that we've been talking about in state government for a number of years, probably for as long as we've had data centers. We've talked about could we consolidate them to produce a better, more stable service at lower cost. The 12 agencies participating have been actively involved in this. One of the things that we did at the beginning of the project was create a governing board to oversee the project. And that governing board, yes?
Senator Frater.
Not to jump ahead a little bit, but to get into this, I look at the agencies involved. I guess I get very concerned. It looks like it's a pick-and-choose sort of thing, and if you want to, you can come on board. I think it's time for Oregon to cut through the turf battles here, especially IRMD. These agencies have absolutely no expertise in IRMD at all. They all have their particular little quirks that they'd like to preserve as unique and particular, and I think that contributes to a duplication of information, misinformation, and an inability of the state of Oregon, its citizens, and the legislature to compare databases. What I'd like to hear about that IRMD is doing with its 300 employees is consolidating OGIN, you know, the judicial system, CJIS, our criminal justice system, the LED system, so that, and frankly with our local partners, so that the sheriffs and the counties and the city police can all talk to one another. If they pick some guy up in Burns, they're gonna know he was in the local correction facility here in Clackamas County. Now, why is that not being pursued? I mean, that's been a huge thing. It's been a terrible frustration of the state legislature.
I'd like to see, I know it's a huge cost perhaps to do that. Frankly, I think the state might be willing to make that sort of investment on its side. I would also expect our local partners to make a substantial investment on their side. Second issue would be the medical management system. Right now, we have no idea what's going on, hospital to hospital. The whole MMIS system's taking, you know, generation to get up and going. By the time it's up and going, it'll be obsolete. Our local providers should also be able to plug in if a person's at Riverbend facility in my neck of the woods, young juvenile seeking mental health counseling. I want them to know that he's been at Oregon State Hospital or had something. We can't do that. That needs to be done. That's what we as legislators are interested in, not all this technical gibberish. I mean, that's great for you guys, and I'm glad you're doing it, and I'm glad it's saving us some money, but the other stuff's more important. And the next big wave that's coming is our education system. We need to make sure that our university system is using the same bloody computers that our community college system's using, or at least the same system that's being used in our local school districts. If we're not doing that sort of thing, I don't really understand, other than, you know, as a cost oversight agency, why you guys actually exist.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator
really
Crater.
A strong opinion. I just
yes. Heard, and I wouldn't disagree with anything that you said. I would tell you that what the Scenic Project is about is it actually positions us to go after some of those additional opportunities.
Let's just do it. Why aren't we doing it? I think as legislature, I suspect every single person right up here right now will be interested in aggressively suggesting to you, as an independent branch of government, that if you all want to get funded next time, let's go ahead and look at these things. Mm-hmm. Let's get off the dime. JLCIMT must be dying. 1,000 deaths. They meet all the time, and we never get anywhere. Can we bring that up with your boss, have a meeting? Co-chairs, I think some of the sub-chairs would be real interested in having this sort of conversation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, certainly we'd be happy to meet with you and talk about that.
Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
For Senator Westland.
Thank you. It may be in my kinder, gentler way. Your answer, we'd be happy about getting together and talking about that. We don't want to talk about it anymore. We want to do it. What we need is time-sensitive, accurate data to help us make good public policy decisions now. See, well, what can we do to help you? We're willing to do it, but just one characterization of the word, and I know you're hearing the message. It's, we don't want to talk about this any longer. We want to do it. And all of us that have been here a number of years have different levels of frustration, all of them higher than great. So it's, help us help you, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, I share that frustration and very committed, as is my boss, to producing positive change. And when I say would like to talk with you about it, what we're talking about is how we would go after those kinds of opportunities.
Senator Winters.
Mr. Chair, because the sentiment on those of us who have had you before us before, and that sentiment rings from, I think, all of us, that I think we're at the point where talking is not enough. I know last session it was extremely painful for us not to be able to depend upon the information that we were receiving, and information that shifted from one month to the next month to one, and so if you hear our frustration, it's very, very real.
Sure.
And it's real enough to say that the patchwork system that exists in Oregon today is not one that I'm sure that those of us who've been here before, and you hear it from Senator Schrader, Senator Weston, and I'm thinking that others down here on this end will say the same thing, that deliver the message back to your manager that this is not about talk.
And Mr. Chair, Senator
Nelson.
Yeah, kind of clear this up as being involved in the Joint Committee of technology for a lot of years. A lot of the issues is there's been a number of directors. The current director, Don Flemming, was on I don't know how long ago, but there's just been a series of directors. There hasn't been any coordination through the governor's office. And so, I mean, we can holler as long as we want to at this office, but they're getting their directions from the governor's office. And I can tell you, one of the former directors told me, he said, the governor, it was a previous governor, and said, I want three things out of you. And one of them was, don't rock the boat. And so a lot of what they're doing, and it's complex, it's expensive to change all these things, a lot of it is coming out of directions out of the governor's office. And I think with the new director, that Don Fleming, as he's coming from the business community, I think you're going to see some of these changes you folks are asking for. I mean, it's hard. I share your frustration as being involved in that committee for a number of years. But there are two sides of the story. And let's holler at these guys and say, okay, we want these things coming out. We want some good information. But we have a new director that I think has some good business background and will be taking that agency in the right direction.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Winters.
The camera's on, and I know that the governor's office monitors this body. They have somebody upstairs that's watching.
They do?
They normally do. So perhaps they're listening to this message as well. Because as we talk about efficiencies, the ability to make state agencies more efficient and more transparent, this is a part of that whole package, and as well as the cost savings.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This is somewhat of a related issue, but I'm not going to endear myself to the DAS people here by saying this, is that one of the things we seem to get into Ways and Means is we have to get the DAS budget out early because of assessments. I would hope that the General Government Committee in this issue and a number of others, even though they have to get the budget out early, would not leave the discussion of DAS alone for the remainder of the session. We'll come back to some of these issues because there is a big urge at the beginning of the session to get that budget out early so we can do the other budget.
And to clarify that point, co-chairs have already had that discussion with Legislative Fiscal, and our focus is on the assessments early, knowing that we are going to leave other issues out there to be fully vetted by the committee. And I know it's a high priority on the House side. Our Speaker's looking at putting a lot of effort through the House Audit Committee with the DAS function. So we're going to be going through a lot of that. And the subcommittee chair, or subcommittee for general government, is going to be getting the benefit of that review as well. And Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with a great deal of the views that have been stated previously. Certainly, in terms of sharing information within the law enforcement arena, it's vital from a public safety standpoint. Senator Winters mentioned in terms of our ability to get data is certainly true, but the same thing applies virtually to every other state employee. Somebody working in the human services field should be able to, if they're verifying food stamps, a food stamp application, should be able to easily check and find out whether or not all of the person applying for benefits actually has custody of children. Coordinating of employment data with benefits. Each time we can simplify this, there's probably some incredible savings both in accuracy as well as speed of our employees. And we've got 37,000 employees that a great many of them depend on being able to exchange information quickly in this age. The obvious problem is it's real expensive. And we've got to figure out, I think one of the things is the legislative will to be willing to go forward and do the long-term commitment to make the kinds of investments that we're going to need in the future. And the other one is always my 20 years of looking at these kind of information issues at different levels of government. We've always got the quandary because the technology is changing so fast and our systems are so complicated, there seems to be a reluctance to step forward and fund something today because there's always a hope that it'll either be cheaper or better a couple of years from now, which in a lot of cases is true. Senator Schrader was saying that by the time we take a generation to develop a system, it's often obsolete. On the other hand, if we don't take a generation to develop it, sometimes we end up with situations like the motor vehicle department where where we waste the public's money with false steps. So somehow we have to have the commitment both to be willing to put the money into these systems, and in some cases actually take some risk in terms of getting the system up and online in a timely manner, even though there is a risk that we may either miss something or create something that has a relatively short lifespan. So it's tough stuff to do, but it's absolutely imperative that we make the effort and give the political backing to going forward.
Representative Morgan.
Well, and I'm not going to belabor the points that have been raised because I think that they're very good and very right on, and all of us that have been working in the budget arena over the last few biennium as we've been trying to grapple with just balancing the books have been very frustrated with the quality of the information that we've had to work with. And from a management perspective, it's very difficult for us to do our job without that coordination. I would just like to urge in the discussions around DAS's budget this time that serious consideration be paid to some incentives within the framework of that document to move the agency in that direction so that there is a clear path there for the agency to move in. And just to reiterate the point that Representative Hansen made, that there's a lot of downside risks here in because of the complexity of the issue. But I think that with the continuum of care that we're trying to establish in the state in all of the policy areas and the complexity of all of the levels that we're looking at, when we try to manage what's effective and what's working, it just becomes so apparent that the quality of the information that we're basing our decisions on at this point is highly suspect. And I think especially in the human services arena, we've learned some pretty tough lessons there, that we've made decisions based on data that has turned out to be very bad data.
Any further questions for now?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westland.
We're just wondering if Mike Voss actually fell down on purpose. We appreciate you being here.
Actually, sir, I was thinking, you know, why do we bring such troublemakers up to the dais?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I want to clarify part of the discussion here, and that is that the governor's office has provided outstanding support for us, particularly for this consolidation project. And, in fact, it's the governor's initiative, which is one of the reasons I think we've gotten much further along than any previous initiative. And the consolidation project, if you think about building a building, it's the foundation for going after some of the very things that you're talking about here. So we have to pour the foundation before we can start building the building, and that's really what Scenic is about. The 12 agencies that are participating in it have been actively involved, and these kinds of big discontinuous change initiatives are kind of scary for people, but they have participated and supported and led this initiative. Their technical leads are involved, and we're at the point now where we're getting the technical staff, the folks who actually operate the current infrastructure involved, and as we do the detailed planning and actually begin moving data centers. And the other thing for sustainability's sake, I talked about shared services being different from centralization, and here's what's really different. The idea in shared services is that we only centralize those things for which there are economies of scale and a high degree of common business need. So things that make sense from a business perspective and for which there's a business case. And then two, the thing that gets centralized remains accountable to those people who are dependent on it for service. So the agency heads will continue to be involved in ongoing governance and oversight so that we can make sure this thing remains efficient and effective and that it supports the business needs of the agencies. As we move further along, we would look at different, what we would call layers in the technology environment. Currently, we're looking at sort of the base layer, the foundation, and we would look at some of those other opportunities that you've talked about in the realms of common applications or in the realm of being able to merge data and provide data in a more accurate and integrated way. And that's part of what the e-government program is about, too. The emergency board approved funding for the facility, and we are currently erecting the data center facility out on Airport Road between the lottery building and the state printing plant. we're dealing with the human resource issues. Sue Wilson's shop is working and is currently engaged in negotiations with SEIU over the impact of this consolidation, because the net result is that there will be fewer FTE performing these functions when we're done than there are today. The IRMD program areas that are within scope for the consolidation project are obviously our data center. We also run the state's centralized network infrastructure. That's all within scope. And the what we call technology support center, which is really the help desk. This is who you would call if you had a technical issue, and those people are responsible for owning that problem and getting it resolved as quickly as possible. The current data center provides application and database hosting. It supports a variety of state agencies, including Department of Administrative Services, and it's going to be one of the first to be consolidated. The first three to be consolidated would be the largest three, Department of Human Services, Department of Transportation, and DAS. And the reason for that is that the bulk of the savings will come from consolidating those three, so we move those as far forward in the project as possible to produce savings at the earliest possible opportunity. The Enterprise Network Services Group I talked about, that's our wide area data network, and we also provide Internet access. We have two primary points of interface with the Internet, both in Eugene and Portland. And so we take care of providing Internet access for state agencies. We also currently provide the central email input system where email comes in from the Internet and synchronize the directories between state agencies. Email consolidation, by the way, is a future opportunity for savings, which we would see pursuing as we get as we begin to get into consolidation of the data centers. So the state currently has multiple email systems. It probably needs something like one email system to serve the needs of the state, and we would go after that opportunity. Now, we also provide audio and video conferencing services. These are becoming increasingly popular because it means less downtime when people are participating in meetings, traveling to and from meetings. So there are some savings associated with that. They're what I call soft savings, hard to calculate, but they're certainly there. And we see that use of those systems increasing.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I attended an emergency management meeting in Montana last February, and the director of their system was there, and they have an integrated system, and it was shut down for several days through a virus attack, and she was very concerned about the security of the system. Now, as we're moving to a unified system, what kind of security are we going to have?
Now, Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, great question. We information security I'll also talk about a little bit later on in the presentation, but what has happened with information technology security over time is that it's a threat that was more of an annoyance about 5 years ago. It was really just someone would get a virus on their computer and send out email messages to everybody they knew to spread the virus, and those kinds of things happen. It was more of a trivial annoyance at that time. Today, it's a serious threat. One of the things that we have done very recently is conducted a comprehensive analysis, a threat and vulnerabilities assessment, and we have produced a plan to mitigate those risks. And it's the same kind of a process that virtually everybody else in the world is going through now who's dependent on information technology that's connected to a network. And we have received some funding from the Emergency Board to put in place some immediate mitigation strategies. One way to think about it is that we're putting up a fence around the state's network, so we have a defensible perimeter. We're also looking at vulnerabilities of existing systems and putting in a comprehensive program to make sure that those systems are patched to mitigate those vulnerabilities, and we're doing some other things.
It was interesting because she said the state system was shut down for 1 or 2 days, and she estimated the cost to employees sitting around not being able to work. And when you think about it, without your system, everything stops.
That's right.
So she even went so far as to attribute the energy crisis back that we had in the East Coast, I think it started in Ohio. She said they don't like to talk about it, but that may have, she attributed it to sabotage of the system. It shut down their system, which led to other system failures. And so it could be a huge security problem.
Thanks. Yes. The other piece that's in scope I talked about is the help desk, because you have to have somebody to call if you experience a problem, and we don't want them calling directly to technicians who are operating the system, so the help desk is the tier one support operation. We're consolidating that. We've already consolidated that function within our organization so that there's a seamless interface for customers, one place to call, and the problem gets taken care of. Some of the things we're trying to demonstrate with this project are, one, that we can actually work together effectively on enterprise strategies. And, you know, I hear some of your frustration today with these issues that have plagued us for a number of years. We, I think, have moved a lot further along than anybody has with a comprehensive consolidation strategy. And we see this as sort of a trailblazing move that will allow us to go after some of those things you talked about. Overcoming institutional barriers to change, resolving some complex business and technical issues, and they are complex. Consolidation is very technically complex, although the path is well known. There's just a lot of issues that need to be dealt with. And in terms of business complexity, we're dealing with funding stream issues and restrictions on funding streams, both federal and dedicated funds. And we're demonstrating, I think, that we can, of our own initiative, be accountable to taxpayers. I think one thing that folks in state government understand very clearly is there's a demand to be accountable and to be to demonstrate the value of government, that we're delivering good value for tax dollars that are invested. And attacking our base, the process I described earlier, to gain efficiencies and effectiveness, and testing out the shared services approach.
Ms. Freeze, just looking at the time, you've only got about 12 more minutes.
So okay, well, I can talk really
keep
fast.
Keep us moving.
I'll move along. Great. Again, we want to save money with the Scenic Program and position the state of Oregon for future initiatives, some of which you talked about today. E-government, pretty simple, modest proposal here. We want to transform state governments from the citizen's perspective. And really what the idea of e-government is the same as electronic business and e-commerce is that it turns the business model on its head, and instead of having a citizen have to come to us on our time, on our turf, using our rules to get something done, it delivers that to them on their time, on their turf, and allows them to conduct business that way. E-government also allows us to begin integrating some systems that are currently disparate and separate. We have a project underway today called Central Business Registry, which would allow somebody who wanted to register a business go to one place and conduct the whole business process rather than having to go to multiple state agencies to get it done. And citizens then don't need to know how we're organized to get something done, citizens and businesses. Oregon.gov is the new state website, which was brought up some time ago. We are using what's called a content management system. One of the problems that we've been plagued with, that everybody's been plagued with, is that as millions and millions of web pages are created, they become unmanageable without an information technology application to do that. That's what content management does. And in fact, when we started implementing Brand Oregon, it would have been impossible to do that without a content management system. We certainly couldn't have afforded to do that. So content management systems allow us to roll out massive changes across every web page that exists within the system. E-commerce allows folks to purchase things online, and we've got a variety of state agencies that are participating in that. And we have an intranet, and that's a separate portal for state employees, and has the capability, as we move forward, to be to understand, for instance, what your rights and privileges and needs are and customize and tailor that content to your needs. So a single place to go for state employees to get access to various applications that they would need access to and various kinds of information. I've got some stats. I'm not going to read through them here, but you get a sense for the volume of transactions that are taking place through this platform. Again, agencies are using this now to conduct business online. People can do things like renew licenses and those kinds of things through the system.
With, Mr. Chair, with all these new efficiencies online, has anyone done an analysis on one, has it produced a reduction in staff as a result of these? Because you're no longer doing it manually, you're doing it electronically. Has there such a study been done and completed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, that's a great question, and I don't think we've reached the tipping point on that yet. One of the problems that we deal with is this need to be able to interface with folks at their level of interface, and while increasingly Internet connectivity is available both through libraries and through homes, state government business model, default business model, is based on paper transactions and those kinds of things. So at some point, I think we're going to be able to cut some of those over so that the default business model is electronic and system-based. That's still sometime in the future. I can't tell you exactly when that's going to happen.
One of the selling points that when members agencies come before us is that we want this because, one, it will reduce the amount of staff we need as well as the transparency and the ability for our customer, the public, to access this point. Mm-hmm. So I would think at some point that we should be able to validate whether that, in fact, has occurred.
Yes.
Okay. The e-government platform allows us to create some new capabilities that don't exist today without building whole new systems. We can integrate some existing systems. We're currently recruiting for a new program manager, and we hope to have that recruitment posted, and we'll bring somebody in sometime in the next couple of months. The geospatial systems, again, the goal is here to ensure availability and access to high-quality geographic information. The same problems that you described in other realms exist with geospatial data, and to make it more complicated, that data comes from a variety of sources. So you have different authoritative sources for different kinds of data. The state provides some of that data. Local government entities provide some of that data. The feds provide some of that data. So it really is kind of a cat-herding exercise to get all that stuff together. But there's tremendous benefit. And geospatial systems, basically what they do is they take a variety of different kinds of data and overlay them on a spatial component, on a map, if you will, so that you can see correlations between different kinds of things based on location. And it's we've seen some tremendous benefits from that, some of which could that could aid you, for example, in public policy deliberations when you're considering the impacts of public policy. But I'll give you a couple quick examples. We have seen cases where lives were saved and property was saved literally because good geospatial information was available, where emergency response crews could take a look at, for instance, where properties existed in maintaining or managing a fire and figure out how to manage that fire so that they could either minimize the damage to those properties or evacuate people in time. We've also had cases where because somebody didn't know, for instance, that a power transmission line existed, people have been injured or even killed because they just weren't aware that that was there. Good geospatial information can provide that. It's one of the greatest areas of coordination, again, between state and local governments, and we are currently, it has a council that oversees this work comprised of state agency, federal people, and local people called OGIC, the Oregon Geographic Information Council. Information security I touched on briefly. The primary purpose is really to secure the assets of a state government to protect the assets, and the threat level is increasing sort of exponentially. If you take a look at that over the last 5 years, it's not a linear type of a progression. It's very much a great big steep curve. So we have to invest more in information technology security, and we have to do it from an enterprise level. Because in information technology, really, because everything is interconnected, we're only as strong as our weakest link. So it's very important that we have good, comprehensive, enterprise-level security, and then there are agency-specific needs.
Representative Wilson. I'm not sure how much time we have. I want to be sure, thank you, my co-chair, that you're going to be looking at the Secretary of State's voter program. It's going to be very expensive, and I understand he's looking at different systems than we have in the state right now. So I hope your system will be looking at that to be sure it's interoperable with everything else.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodson, yes, that's one of the strategic investments that I talked about earlier, and we have been involved with and met with them, and also working with them on where those systems will be located. So, yes, we are involved in that. The key elements here, there's another component to this. It's not just about putting in place some technical standards and some technology to protect us. It's a behavioral thing as well. So even the best system can be thwarted if people don't follow rules and follow good practices. There's a training component to this that we want to ingrain into the culture, and we need to take the state of Oregon up to a level of appropriate mitigation of security risk. And we're not there today, but we're working very hard on that. We find ourselves in the same position that many other both public and private entities find themselves. Business continuity planning, that's really what it's all about. It's about being able to maintain continuity in the event of some kind of a disruption in operations. And because our business processes and our technologies are increasingly interconnected, it's really not possible to produce just an agency-specific business continuity plan. Because if I have a business process that I would rank as number one priority, but I'm dependent on you for a business process that you rank as number 36, I'm probably going to have a problem bringing my systems back up. So we're working with multiple agencies on an enterprise business continuity planning process. It will identify the top business processes within state government, and it'll be an enterprise plan that will make sure that we can continue in the event of a disruption. Some of the drivers, of course, are obviously we don't want to have disruptions in service, but literally funding streams can be at risk if we don't appropriately mitigate those kinds of risks. Finally, let me close by saying that information technology, I mean, we don't do this just because information technology is fun, and although maybe some of the folks do, our technicians are in it for that reason. We do it because information technology is supposed to enable the business of state government, and it should also be a productivity enhancer. That's the primary reason that we exist, to support the business missions of state government. And there are numerous opportunities using information technology to do that more efficiently and effectively and to make government more transparent to citizens. IRMD, my organization, is continuing its efforts to improve its capability and to really reposition the organization to be a lot more effective in going after some of the things that you've talked about today. And the enterprise programs that we're putting in place really are approached in a collaborative way. Why? Because it's really the most effective way to get them moving forward quickly, to make sure that the agency business needs are supported in the process and to ensure sustainability of those enterprise initiatives over time. So we want to be able to use strategic planning to drive future initiatives, to go after those things that will produce the greatest value. And leadership from agencies has been provided willingly and enthusiastically to help us go after some of those initiatives. That concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Morrison.
How much does this stuff end up on Google?
Senator Moore said, how much of which stuff ends up on Google?
Everything that you're talking about, right, that are picked up and put on the World Wide Web that they have access to, can they get into our system? Can someone get into our system by accessing through a different platform like Google?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore said, for those things that are public-facing, the things that we want to be generally available to the public, yes, that's true. For those things that are not, no. Those would be what we would see on the intranet.
Okay.
Or even...
That was my question, good, because there may be things that we don't want to...
Absolutely.
Okay, that was my concern, that you can find almost everything.
Yes. It would not be a good thing to, for instance, be able to find our detailed cybersecurity plan through a Google search, so we would make sure that would never happen.
Firewall will circle.
Yes.
Good.
Absolutely.
Any other questions? Mr. Priest? All right. Thank you very much. And colleagues, just real quick, at least tentative at this point, it's looking like the House chamber is going to be convening at 8:30 on Friday, which means our full Ways and Means Committee will be pushed back till probably about 9:30. And once we get that resolved, we'll get another agenda announcement out. Okay. And with that, we are adjourned.